This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
I had a long and very enjoyable conversation with an elementary school principal last week as she was getting ready for the new school year. And one topic we kept coming back to was dealing with students who have seizures in class, which is apparently a lot more common than you'd think. And it seems not all seizures are created equal.
People can just have behavioral arrest where they just stare off into space and are completely unresponsive to people around them. People can have just funny feelings, repetitive feelings of deja vu. They can have repetitive episodes of right arm jerking.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll listen to a conversation with two doctors who specialize in epilepsy and see how this condition is affecting more and more students' lives. We'll also spend an academic minute getting into some heavy metal. I'm Bob Barry, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Millions of people in the United States are living with epilepsy, and unless they were in the middle of a seizure, chances are you couldn't pick out a single one of them. The word epilepsy is derived from the Greek word for attack. People once thought that those with epilepsy were being visited by demons or gods. However, in 400 BC, the early physician Hippocrates suggested that epilepsy was a disorder of the brain, and today, of course, we know he was right. Here to talk about epilepsy are a pair of doctors who specialize in the condition at Albany Medical Center Hospital in Albany, New York. Dr. Timothy Lynch is an assistant professor of neurology, and Dr. Matthew Adamo is an assistant professor of pediatrics and neurosurgery at Albany Med. I asked Dr. Lynch just what is epilepsy, or what would a patient have to show him to say, ah, that's epilepsy?
That's a great question, because usually it's not what they show us, it's usually what they tell us, because it's an intermittent illness, so they are almost never actually doing it in the office. But the easiest way to describe epilepsy is to say it's a collection of seizures, two or more seizures typically, or one seizure with a predisposition for more, an abnormal MRI, an abnormal EEG. And people with epilepsy or seizures can have many different types of seizures. They can have seizures that we're very familiar with, generalized shaking, generalized stiffness, tongue biting, you know, falling to the ground, again, what I call Hollywood seizures, things that people typically do on TV or movies. People can just have behavioral arrest where they just stare off into space and are completely unresponsive to people around them. People can have just funny feelings, repetitive feelings of deja vu. They can have repetitive episodes of right arm jerking. But all of these things have in common hypersynchronous or hyperactive abnormal brain rhythm in an area of the brain or the entire brain that causes these collection of symptoms. And the symptoms are based on where in the brain the seizure starts and how it spreads.
Eventually, will all of these things come to a big seizure?
Usually. Yeah. There are patients I've had who have had just years and years and years of small seizures, and they never actually get a big grand mal seizure. But usually patients either present because they eventually did have the big seizure, or their seizures become more frequent. Instead of one every several months, they start going to every several weeks to once a week to multiple times a week. But typically, if unprotected, meaning they're not appropriately treated or medicated, they usually do progress, become more severe, and usually end up in a grand mal or tonic-clonic seizure.
How widespread is this? Is this something that we're recognizing a lot more now?
It depends on how you diagnose it. So in the past, people would diagnose epilepsy as two or more unprovoked seizures, meaning you're otherwise doing well and you weren't just hit on the head with a baseball bat, for example, or you didn't just get a meningitis. But a lot of people will put a number that, 1% of the population has seizures and epilepsy. Now, if you define it again as one seizure with a predisposition to more, I think the numbers go up to about 10%. I think people are recognizing it pretty well as to what seizures are. In fact, I think people err, perhaps appropriately so, on overestimating or at least overdiagnosing. Patients may have things that look like seizures that aren't. But I think that's important because that way they can be seen and evaluated and then ruled in or out, by a specialist. As opposed to undercalling it and then not getting people appropriate treatment.
How has the understanding of just what's going on changed over the years? I'm sure it started out as evil spirits and it's progressed to something a little more scientific.
Yeah, back in the day it was, in fact, I had a patient once whose grandmother, this may have only been 10 years ago, whose grandmother thinks he just needed an exorcist and that this, he was just, possessed by the devil. And that's probably one of the problems they had in the Salem witch trials or girls with epilepsy. But I think people are understanding to the degree that yet we can. I know that sounds like a vague answer. What epilepsy is, it is this abnormal brain rhythm, but we're still very in the dark about, you know, why this rhythm is even starting. I mean, we do know that the brain is irritable, it's injured, and that is why these abnormal rhythms are coming out. But for example, in someone who has epilepsy, you know, why did they not seize today and they are going to seize tomorrow, or they seized 2 weeks ago but not 3 weeks ago? Why an individual seizure starts, we don't even know that. Or we're just learning now that what used to look like a, you know, a spreading fire of seizure activity in the brain, it is much more complex. There's the fire, but then there's all the neurons and nerve cells around the fire that's trying to put it out. And we just now we're learning the difference between cells that are actively involved in the seizure and cells that are actually trying to stop the seizure. So we still don't know a lot.
Is family history any kind of component in this? If like you have relatives that have it, you have to keep a pretty good eye on yourself?
It certainly is a risk factor. When someone comes in and wants to be evaluated for seizures or epilepsy, we ask various questions. Have they had febrile seizures? Have they had significant brain injury? Not just concussions, but, you know, coma, things that required neurosurgical intervention.
Okay, I'm going to stop you for a second there. Febrile seizures. What are we talking about there?
So febrile seizures, there's a typical febrile seizure, which is a very limited, generalized shaking in an infant or toddler with high fever, not, you know, 99.3, but, you know, 104, mm-hmm. you know, type of thing. But it's very self-limited. It's a very quick seizure, you know, might be a minute of generalized shaking, and afterwards the baby is happy and playful, no problem. Mm-hmm. Those usually do not go on to have epilepsy, meaning seizures outside of the fever or seizures when they're an adult. But it is a risk factor. Some patients will go on later to develop epilepsy in an adult. And the question is always, what's the underlying cause? You know, patients who have had a febrile seizure because they have an underlying brain abnormality are going to have epilepsy later on in life. They just happen to have their first seizure with a fever when their body was stressed. There is, in fact, we talked about family history, there's a genetic predisposition where family members are known to have febrile seizures. And so those are actually good to hear, because we know the family predisposition is that they have febrile seizures, and then the predisposition is they outgrow it and don't have epilepsy. Mm-hmm. So they tie in together, actually.
Is there any rhyme or reason as to when this starts presenting in somebody? I mean, there's no real age where you can say, well, here's, so you got to watch out for epilepsy.
There is, and that's something we know a little bit about, but not enough about. So there are certain epilepsy syndromes that are very age-dependent. So, for example, infantile spasms occur in infants, obviously. Juvenile myoclonic epilepsy occurs typically in juveniles. They're appropriately named. However, there's certainly exceptions to the rule. I have patients with JMU who have had their first seizure in their 40s. But basically, I think it depends, again, what the underlying problem is and what stage of development the brain is in. So adults will never have what looks like an infantile spasm in an infant, because their brain is a certain maturational level. For the same reason, someone who may have a genetic predisposition to have seizures will typically begin, you know, for example, absence epilepsy at age 7. Well, if it's genetic, why didn't they seize from day 1? And it's just that their brain hasn't matured to have the ability to have that type of seizure given that abnormality. A lot of depends.
Mm-hmm. And then there's some that can be caused by injury?
Certainly. And again, we talk about things that kind of run all together with patients. All of them have an abnormal predisposition to seizures. Their brain is irritable, for lack of a better word. And it can be irritable because it's injured from a tumor. It could be irritable because it's injured from a hemorrhage or blood that's irritating the brain. It could be injured because they have a genetic predisposition so that one of the electrolyte channels, for example, a sodium channel in their cells is not quite functioning and puts them at risk for having seizures. So many different reasons, certainly trauma is one of them.
Well, let's talk about treatment. You have a patient there, someone with epilepsy, they've just been diagnosed. What's the first step?
So the first step is, if you know they have epilepsy, or at least pretty sure that they have epilepsy such that you want to start treatment, the first treatment's always a medication. There are many medications out there. We typically break them down right now into older generation medications, Dilantin, phenobarbital, Depakote, Tegretol, because they've been around longer, but almost more importantly, they have more side effects. You have to draw blood work to check liver enzymes. They tend to make people feel more tired, sleepy, have more cognitive effects, more drug-drug interactions. And the newer medications, the Keppras, Lamictals, Topamax, Zonegran, and yet even more that are coming out. And those tend to be better because they tend to have less side effects. They tend to be less sedating. They tend to have less drug-drug interactions. You typically don't have to do blood monitoring for these medications. Now, which one you pick partly depends on what type of epilepsy they have, although a lot of medications can be used for any type. Fortunately, none of the medications tend to be any better or weaker at actually controlling the seizures. All of the medications across a population of people are equally effective. That being said, one individual person may respond better to one medication than another, but unfortunately, that becomes a trial and error. So for an individual patient, you try to find, again, one of the newer generation medications because they tend to be tolerated better. And if they have any other problem, you try to get things that might go well together. So for example, if they have migraines as well, you might use a medication like Topamax or Zonegran, which can also be used for migraines. If they're on a lot of medications, you might use a medication that has virtually no drug-drug interactions. So those are the kind of things we look at. But again, at the end of the day, it's a bit of a trial and error.
And I'm sure it starts off with, you know, a doctor's had great success with this medication, with this patient. He's going to start there.
Absolutely. You get comfortable with a certain set of drugs you use. And certainly most physicians tend to start with things they learned about in residency because that's the things they've been guided with.
If the medications aren't working, and how can you tell if if you're just saying, you know what, the meds aren't working. What has to happen for you to do that?
So the simplest answer is they're still having seizures. So it's you don't tell the patient, they tell you. I had a seizure on this date, or I'm still having seizures. Or sometimes they're seizure free, but they have intolerable side effects. And typically, if they've failed two or obviously more medications, we call them medically refractory, meaning they're extremely unlikely to be cured, so to speak, meaning they're not going to have any seizures just with medications alone. And that number is actually very low. So if you fail two or more medications, your odds of being completely seizure-free just with medications falls below 5%. And then we look for other treatment modalities.
Are there numbers of treatment of seizures that are like acceptable? I said, well, if you have one a year, the meds are working.
It depends on the patient. Yeah. By and large, we want no seizures, period. So we usually say if someone has gone a year without seizures, that they are seizure-free. Even one a year is too many because, frankly, you're not going to be driving. Mm-hmm. And we often look at it as what can get someone back behind the wheel of a car and driving. So we look for zero seizures. That being said, if someone has significant cognitive deficits and they couldn't be driving anyway, and you know, it's just really not or really minimally affecting their life, we can be less aggressive in treatment because we don't want the cure to be worse than the disease.
Still to come, our conversation about epilepsy continues with a look at what happens when the meds aren't working. We'll get the answer to that next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. We're talking about seizures and epilepsy today with Dr. Timothy Lynch, an assistant professor of neurology, and Dr. Matthew Adamo, an assistant professor of pediatrics and neurosurgery at Albany Medical Center. We've been talking with Dr. Lynch about the medications used to treat epilepsy. The next topic, so the meds are not working. Now what?
So the next step is simply bringing someone in to the hospital for long-term video EEG monitoring to determine, one, if they're having epilepsy. You know, a lot of patients are being treated for epilepsy, and the reason the medications aren't working is because they don't have epilepsy. And if they do have epilepsy, then we have other treatments usually in a surgical nature for those patients.
A quick aside here, what else could it be?
Actually, the most common thing we see are psychological events that look like seizures. So there's a number of terms for this: pseudo seizures, non-epileptic events, non-epileptic behavioral events, stress seizures. But basically, things that look like epileptic seizures: falling to the ground, shaking, staring off, being unresponsive, focal shaking, any of the above that look just like epileptic seizures, but the brainwaves are completely normal during this time. That's probably the most common reason someone has events that look like seizures. Probably number two might be syncope or fainting. People can drop their blood pressure just like any normal will faint. And typically people, when they faint, they fall to the ground and are still and get right back up. But some people, depending how long they're down for or how long the blood is not getting to the brain, they can have all kinds of jerking motions that people mistake for seizures. They can lose urine. They can bite their tongue. All kinds of things that can be confusing. In fact, just this past week alone, I had two patients go for what's called tilt table testing to assess for syncope. One was sent to me for a question of seizures, and the other had already been treated by someone else for 4 years with seizure medication. And it didn't sound like seizure to me, so I sent them in, and lo and behold, they have syncope. Diabetes, people who drop their blood sugar can lose consciousness and have events that look like seizures. So lots of different things.
Okay, so you bring somebody in for observation. What's done there?
So we have, at Albany Med, we have a 6-bed monitoring unit where patients come in. They have an EEG hooked up to their head, so a bunch of electrodes that are put on their head. Typically, this is an outpatient process where someone looks at the brain waves for about 20 minutes, 30 minutes. But in this case, we bring them in and we look for 24 hours, multiple days in a row, depending on how long we have to look. If they're on seizure medications, we quickly wean them off to try to induce seizures because we want to see if they're having a seizure, you know, what type of seizure it is, where is it coming from? Or if they're not having seizures, what are they having? Are they having syncope? Are they having pseudo seizures? Because ultimately, you have to treat the underlying problem.
This is the one time you actually want somebody to have a seizure.
Yeah. In fact, it's funny. Most of the time, we bring people to the hospital to get better. And in our unit, we bring them to the hospital to, you know, break some eggs to make an omelet. They'll say, oh, I had an awful night's sleep last night. And most of the time, you know, in the hospital, it's like, oh, that's too bad. We want you to have a good night's sleep. But we're actually kind of happy when someone has a bad night's sleep because their system is stressed and they're more likely to have a seizure.
So, okay, the medications aren't working. And I guess at this point, we start talking about surgery. And Dr. Adamo, this is your specialty that we're getting into now. Surgery for epilepsy, something I'm sure not many people are familiar with. Where do we go from here?
And you mentioned that this is not that well known to many people. One reason is that in the past, people would go, you know, many, many years on many medications before even thinking about surgery as an option because it was thought to be a last resort type treatment. But what we're finding out now is that the earlier intervene is actually better because there is that period of time where those medications have bad side effects. The seizures themselves over time can have bad side effects. So ideally, if there is any question of any surgical intervention, that decision is made earlier on, like Dr. Lynch mentioned. Once you're considered intractable, that's time to think about surgery. But as far as the different operations that are available, it's always tailored to each patient's specific epilepsy and where their seizures are coming from. But, you know, in general terms, we either do brain operations where we take out part of the brain or a lesion in the brain, or we do a stimulator kind of operation. When it comes to the brain surgeries, they vary in invasiveness from very tiny, very focal resections to actually taking out half of a child's brain if they have a catastrophic epilepsy. So in the best cases, we have a nice localized EEG. We have an MRI that may or may not show an abnormality, but we know we're at least localized to one half of the brain. And then we do a series of different testing from the neurology team. We do neuropsychiatric testing. We may even do what's called a WADA test to assess the size of the brain, what language is on and memory function is on, because the location of the seizures may interfere with those structures if we were to go after them. If a patient meets all the criteria that they're safe for an operation, then we think about what they specifically need. And as I mentioned, the operation can be a very small resection of a couple centimeters of brain. It can be a whole lobe, like a whole temporal lobe or frontal lobe. It can be what's called the corpus callosotomy. We actually split the brain into two separate halves. Or it can be actually taken out one half of the brain called the hemispherectomy.
You understand there are tons of people listening right now going,
all these things sound very scary, but the point is we only put patients into the surgical arm of treatment if they have an epilepsy that we think is the right kind to go after surgically. Mm-hmm. You know, children, especially young children, can tolerate much more aggressive resections and recover function because their brain is still growing and still developing. So if I say take a half of someone's brain, that sounds crazy, but actually in a young, very young child, that child is expected to be able to walk and use their arm at some point in life, even though they're missing half of their brain. So they will recover a lot of the function that we take out. For most adults, we really try to do more tailored resections, more, you know, smaller areas or keep it within one lobe.
In a perfect situation, unlike the medications where you have to be on the medication and you're never really cured, you're just controlled, this, and if it all works out right, you're cured.
I mean, there's a chance for a cure, but again, it's tough to tell a person we're going to definitely cure epilepsy. We'd give them numbers more like, say, 80-90%, depending on the situation, even less for certain epilepsies. You know, frontal lobe seizures, maybe 50-60%, depending on how many foci there are, if it's very complicated. If someone's post-traumatic, a severe brain injury with numerous scarred areas and abnormalities on the MRI scan and different areas that the brain's atrophied or kind of shriveling, the success rate will be lower because there's so much potential damage that's already been caused by their trauma. We go and take a small area out, it's all that remaining damaged tissue that may now become a seizure focus.
Okay.
You know?
And I think something that's important to point out, I think that maybe you alluded to a little bit on your question, is that when this surgery is performed, the patients stay on their medications at least initially, full doses of all their medications at least initially. Because like Dr. Adamo says, we don't really know, because unfortunately the brain's not labeled for us, that we got the whole epileptic focus. We may have just gotten enough so that the seizure medications now work 100%. And even then we don't know, you know, if they come in on two meds, do they need two meds? Do they need one med? Maybe we did in fact cure them. And so that decision making is again another long-term process. Typically for the first year, as long as they're feeling well, we don't touch their medications.
It sounds like you're just starting from scratch again.
Right. Right. And then depending on how they're doing, it's a little bit up to the patient. You know, the patient may say, boy, this is the first time in 20 years I've gone a year without a seizure. I don't want to touch my medications. Mm. And, you know, others want them off as fast as they can.
Mm-hmm. Finally, is there anything new on the horizon that you're looking forward to? It's like, oh, I can't wait till this is perfected because then we'll be able to do this.
There's always everything new. There's always new drugs that are coming down the line. I'm always a little skeptical in terms of the next best thing because it just seems that every drug that comes out, I think for a very small percentage of people, it will be the next best thing. But in terms of a cure-all for everyone, I don't really see that. But it's always another option. It's always another something that someone may just simply tolerate better. So that's always new. There's always other procedures people are working on.
From a surgical standpoint, there is some work on deep brain stimulation. So, you know, placing a small electrode into the brain, much less traumatic, much less invasive. And if that ends up being the way things are going, then that's just better for patients. They can tolerate the operations better. They also may have less fear of having an operation because it's not going to require a big resection of brain tissue. It might just be a wire being placed in the brain.
Dr. Timothy Lynch is an assistant professor of neurology, and Dr. Matthew Adamo is an assistant professor of pediatrics and neurosurgery at Albany Medical Center Hospital in Albany, New York. There is some serious research being done on heavy metal, and it has nothing to do with music. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Cadmium is a common environmental pollutant. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College, and this week we're featuring women in STEM fields. Today on the Academic Minute, Ami Zota, assistant professor of environmental and occupational health at George Washington University, discusses the health risks associated with the heavy metal.
Human exposure to a metal known as cadmium is considered a major public health concern by the World Health Organization. Cadmium is a metal that occurs in nature, but is also produced by industrial sources to make batteries, pigments, and plastics. People can accumulate cadmium by eating food grown in contaminated soil, inhaling cigarette smoke, or simply by living near industrial sites. Previous studies have suggested that cadmium can increase the risk that people will suffer from chronic diseases, possibly by shortening bits of DNA called telomeres. Located deep within the cells, telomeres are thought to keep the genetic material located on chromosomes from being destroyed. My colleagues and I recently published the largest study ever done on human exposure to cadmium and telomeres. Scientists believe that when telomeres are shortened by environmental pollutants and other factors, diseases of old age can strike relatively early in life. In this study, we looked at blood from 6,700 people taking part in a survey of the U.S. population conducted by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We looked at the amount of cadmium in the blood and obtained DNA from each sample so that we can measure the length of the telomeres. We found that people with the highest amount of cadmium in the blood had telomeres that were about 6% shorter than those in the lowest group, equivalent to an additional 11 years of aging. This study suggests there may be no safe level of exposure to this heavy metal, which is a widespread pollutant in the United States and around the world.
That was Ami Zota of George Washington University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.